to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 117, otherwise known as season 6, episode 18. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How are you doing, Jacob?
Doing good. Currently on the East Coast, visiting family for Thanksgiving, so happy I get to sleep in a little later than you guys.
You're in the future.
Yep, 3 hours into the future.
Also with us, as always, is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, Correa?
I think it's kind of funny that I'm known for making the bad dad jokes, and yet you're the one that always hits the time zone. You're in the future joke.
Don't tell us what happens, though. I want to be surprised.
Okay.
I think we need to get you be the one to be known for the dad jokes now.
What's going on, you guys? The big release this week that I think we can't wait to talk about is Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I know we've all seen it. What'd you guys think?
Well, I was fortunate enough to see it at a pre-screening a couple weeks back at Beyond Fest, and you know, they went all out. Like, they were handing out John Carver the Pilgrim masks, and they even had corn holder hats, so it looked like the corn holders were in your ears.
Nice.
And Eli Roth was there for the Q&A, and it was the right crowd for it too, because like everybody was screaming and laughing, and I have to say it might be my favorite Eli Roth movie now, because it just really captures the style and fun of particularly holiday slashers and slashers from the 80s and 90s. And just to give some backstory, so it's basically about Plymouth, Massachusetts, a year after there was a massacre at a Black Friday store opening, and a dude dressed up as a pilgrim, an actual pilgrim named John Carver. He is historically accurate.
Perfect name for a slasher villain, John Carver.
Yeah, because he does do a lot of carving. But anyway, yeah, so he starts killing people off in Plymouth one by one. And yeah, there's some really great sequences in this. Particularly, I was a fan of the diner kill, which you see a bit in the trailer, where like he sticks that lady's head in water, then smashes her into the freezer.
That one kept going.
The funniest part of that one to me is they were leaning into, like, because I was expecting it to be more grindhouse, more like a 70s aesthetic, and it was more like Scream. It was real modern, but it was still paid tribute to the slashers. But the funniest part of that was, like, she tried to open her phone to call 911, and there's so much blood that she can't open it. Then she tried to use facial recognition, but because her face, half of it was frozen off, it wouldn't recognize her, so she couldn't get her phone open.
And that's the actual thing. At the screening, Eli Roth even talked about that he treated this feature adaptation version compared to the original Grindhouse trailer to being like if they had made a remake of Thanksgiving from the original Grindhouse version. So like, so basically imagine if this had been along the lines of My Bloody Valentine 3D Friday the 13th, or it feels kind of like those 2000s, Platinum Doom slasher remakes.
I'm glad you said that.
I loved Thanksgiving. I had so much fun with it. And like I said, it surprised me that it was more modern, but it was a pleasant surprise, because I kind of thought it would have leaned too hard into the 70s shtick if it had done it that way. I had so much fun with it, though. It just reminded me of something like Scream, where, you know, it's basically like a mystery slasher. And I loved it. I mean, it was gory. It was gruesome. I had so much fun with it.
Korea. I'm glad you said that, too, because I did look it up after, because I did, you know, what the original Thanksgiving fake trailer was my favorite Eli Roth project, you know. So I did spend like a good portion of the movie going, oh, this is the scene where they're going to do that bit. Oh, this is the scene where they're going to do that bit. And then they didn't.
It sticks pretty close to the trailer. I mean, it looks like that is a trailer for this. They stuck pretty close with with the gags from the trailer.
Well, I mean, yeah, there were a few times where like it subverted it, but I did read, you know, that it was treated more like a kind of a remake of that, and that they didn't want to go for that a sec. They did want to create it as its own. So I was like, okay, I can respect that. My two qualms with that, though, is the clown bit. Wow, is there a clown in the Thanksgiving parade? That just felt like the killer was like rushed and couldn't find another thing. And the final shot of the trailer. Do you guys remember the final shot of the trailer? It's the scene where he has them all at the dinner table, and it shows grandma is, you know, burnt and like the turkey and all that stuff. And then they have grandma's head on the turkey, and then the trailer ends with the killer fornicating with the cooked turkey with grandma's head on it. And that's not in the movie. I feel like from here out, the two things that we spoil is dogs dying and no turkey fucking scene, because that disappointed me greatly. But I get it also, because that is a very like 70s, 80s, like going for shock thing. And then if you're going for like more of like a 90s, 2000 slasher aesthetic, that they didn't really do stuff like that too much there. So like, I get it, but also, but can a man be disappointed that there was no turkey fucking scene? Like, come on, that was... But I'd say it's probably my most liked Eli Roth movie. I don't know if it's entirely my vibe, you know. So, you know, but I think it also could have been my crowd. We saw it at City Walk, and we were like in the third row from the front, and still saw I counted five phones open during the movie. There was people giving like commentary to literally anything that fucking happened in the movie. Was someone going, "Oh wow, whoa, he did that! Oh man, whoa!" Geez. Which, like, listen, it's fine to react to things. It's fine to go, "Ooh," it's fine to go, "Ah." But like, listen, this isn't MST3K. You don't have to fucking say something every time something happens. There's other people having conversations. There was one dude who was doing the loudest yawns the entire time. And he was loving the movie. I don't know why he was being... Basically, what I'm saying is my crowd sucked, and it sucked any joy I was getting out of that movie. But I still liked it. It was fine.
I told you guys about my Killers of the Flower Moon experience. So sounds like that guy went up to your screening of Thanksgiving.
But that's the thing. It wasn't just one guy. It was like, there was like five or six different people that were doing stuff. And what was it? There was like one scene in like the third act that was like really quiet. And this motherfucker was going to town on either on like their drink. Like, I mean, like full on like swishing around. It was just like, are you doing this on purpose? You're doing this on purpose, aren't you? I did find it funny though, because we saw it at City Walk. So I had to go to the comic book store next door, and I did get, drip checked by the cashier, because he was like, "Oh, do you want a Thanksgiving poster?" And I was like, "Sure." He's like, "Yeah, well, you're wearing a waxwork shirt and a Fright Rags sweater, so I figured you'd want one." And I was just like, "Wow, way to call out my drip, bud. Thanks." So I have a poster.
Also, I wanted to bring up, because it's just funny that they happen to release around the same time that Tyler McIntyre and Michael Kennedy's It's a Wonderful Knife also came out this weekend.
Oh, I didn't see it on any theater listings.
Yeah, it got a much smaller release, but it did hit some theaters, and I imagine it's going to hit VOD soon. But it is kind of funny, because Michael Kennedy was tweeting that he wanted to do kind of a Barbenheimer thing with it, like It's a Wonderful Thanksgiving or Knifesgiving or one of those, and asking people to double feature it.
Well, I guess it's because of Hunger Games, right? Because the Hunger Games came out, because like there was a few theaters where it's like they had like four screens dedicated to it. But like, I was trying to see Saltburn instead, because I was like, oh, those guys are going to cover Thanksgiving. Like, I'll go see Saltburn. That's more my vibe anyways. And like, there was like two theaters near me playing it, and they were fully booked out. And it was just like, what the fuck? But
speaking of Hunger Games, either you guys see it? The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes?
Nah.
I love the Hunger Games. Those four movies. This one was pretty disappointing. It's kind of not really an origin story. It's about the 10th Hunger Games, which I guess in the original batch of movies, they talk about how there's another winner from District 12 before Haymitch, but nothing is known about them, and they presume that they're dead and everything. Well, this is about, you know, and I'm kind of spoiling it, but you can tell it's coming a mile away in the movie. This is about that Hunger Games and that winner. And President Snow is like a college student, and this is the first mentor program they had, where instead of using past winners, they have these the people up for this prestigious college prize are mentoring the Hunger Games contestants, the tributes, and he gets assigned. Her name's Lucy Gray, and he gets assigned her as a tribute to mentor. And the first two thirds of it feels like an asylum version of the Hunger Games. Oh, I mean, but then, and that's up to and including the actual games themselves, which are much lower scale. It's like an actual, like a Coliseum arena. It's not like they put them in like a jungle or on an island. It's, you know, all 24 tributes are actually in the middle of this arena. So it's more like, gladiator dueling than, you know, the Hunger Games that we know from the other movies. But the last third of it is just this, I mean, I won't say unnecessary because there's a lot of story there, but it's this epilogue about basically the post Hunger Games for President Snow, who they call him Corey. They call him Corio. That's his nickname, but, he gets into trouble for helping his mentor, and he, you know, it's the post games between him and Lucy Gray. And it was a little disappointing. I kind of wish they had left the Hunger Games legacy alone, you know. And I know that there are hardcore Hunger Games fans who are like going to be okay with it and probably mad at me for not liking it, but eh.
It's based off a book though, right? This is
It's based off a book that was written after the other one. It's a cash in because the other three books, which they turned into four movies, were so huge. So yeah, they wrote this other book, and there's a story there because there is mystery surrounding this other tribute. But they don't really, I mean, I don't want to spoil that, but they don't really solve any of that mystery. I mean, they tell you who this person is, but they don't, you know, there will probably be a part two, I guess, that tells you what happens, you know, that they're keeping from you, that, you know, they had to wipe this tribute from history. But anyway,
I'm all set. I saw the first one in theaters and I was like, cool.
You haven't seen Catching Fire or either the Mockingjays? Oh, Catching Fire is probably the best. That's like the Empire Strikes Back of the group. I think, you know, I love all four of those movies. I do think Mockingjay could have been one movie, and the first Mockingjay could have been just like 30 minutes at the beginning of the second one. But, you know, hey, they have to get an extra $12 from everybody to see it. So they made two.
Back when it was $12, huh?
Yeah. Back then, yeah.
It was a while. And speaking of new releases, have either of you seen Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage?
Nope, I'm seeing it Tuesday. They screened that. The press screening for that was the same night as the press screening of Thanksgiving. They've been doubling us up so hard, and we have been having to make tough choices. But anyway, no, I have not.
Yeah, no. Well, I will say I saw it last Friday. I really dug it. So yeah, at Beyond Fest, Nicolas Cage actually came to the screening we did. I didn't get to watch it then, but at the Q&A, he was saying that this was one of the five screenplays he had to star in and make into a movie. So he really gives it his all in this. And the basic premise is Nicolas Cage plays this very milquetoast and kind of meek evolutionary biology professor at a college, and all these people start dreams about him, even people he doesn't know and has never met. And so it's just kind of about him coming to grips with that and the fame that comes with it and what happens in the fallout. And this might be one of Nicolas Cage's funniest movies, and also one of his most interesting performances. It has a lot to do with kind of memes and having Nicolas Cage play a character who's basically mimetic, you know, kind of comes full circle. It's hard to get into it without spoiling too much, but I will say there is a scene where there are some Nightmare on Elm Street does come up quite a bit, and he's compared to Freddy Krueger.
I was going to say, it kind of sounds like that concept. Everybody's dreaming of the same dude.
Kind of, yeah. It's funny, at one point, like, he actually a photo shoot for Rue Morne magazine, you know, the horror magazine.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So they're very open about that. But it's basically, what if Freddy Krueger needed a PR team?
That's great.
Yeah. No, and it's got a pretty stacked cast, because you got like Dylan Baker, Michael Cera, Tim Meadows. A lot of people really are really great acting off of Nicolas Cage. So I'd recommend it.
Another thing I saw that's not really horror, but it is pretty horrifying. I saw Napoleon.
Oh, ooh, how was that?
You know, it's really divisive. I loved it. But there were a lot of people who hated it. I've heard people calling it uninspiring and unimaginative. And I didn't see any of that. I thought it was fantastic. I think what a lot of people are having a problem with is, and I actually didn't have a problem with this, it's in English, even though all the characters are, well, some of them are British, but most of them are French or Russian or Austrian, you know. And but so everybody speaks English, and they don't really even speak, like Joaquin Phoenix's Napoleon doesn't have an accent. And I was actually happy about that, because they didn't have him going in there and going, you know, ha ha ha, I do this for France. You know, he didn't, you know, lean into the Pepe Le Pew. You know, he just, and people are like, oh, he sounds Californian. And it's like, well, yeah, but if you're not going to do it in French, do it this way. But it's pretty gruesome. I mean, put it this way. The movie starts with the execution of Marie Antoinette at the guillotine. Nice. And it shows it graphically.
Oh boy.
The first scene, I'm like, oh, okay, you have my attention. And the battle scenes are incredible. There's one of them where he's fighting, I believe, the Russian army. And they show a little bit of this in the commercials that I've seen, but there's a reveal in this battle of what Napoleon has done. He basically lays a trap for this Russian army. The battle scenes are incredible. But I had a lot of fun with it. I mean, it's weird to say this. One thing that does deserve to be spoiled: this isn't a dog, but a horse dies graphically. It's one of his first battles as a general, because basically it follows pretty closely his rise from being promoted to brigadier general through his Waterloo. You know, the way that they reveal the Waterloo is kind of funny, because he's planning it out and he's going to be fighting like three different armies. He's like, okay, we will lure this one here and this one here, and then we will all meet here. And he points down with his pointer to the map, and it's all Waterloo, you know. So it's like the whole audience is like, ah. It follows the history pretty closely. The one thing that there is a problem that I did have a problem with the history. Well, anyway, back to the horse before I move on from it. It shows his horse getting shot out from under him with a cannon. And it's pretty graphic. And from what I hear, Ridley Scott pretty much used practical effects for most of the movie. So
it was a real horse.
No. Yeah.
Oh, damn, he blew up a horse.
They really shot a cannonball into a horse. No, but the one issue I had with it is the portrayal of Josephine, and it's not the actress. She's played by Vanessa Kirby, who was in that, I don't remember the name of it. She was in that movie about abortion with Shia LaBeouf a couple years back. She's really good, but the portrayal of Josephine is really meek and kind of weak. And Josephine was not a meek or a weak person. She kind of put Napoleon in his place in a lot of places, because you get the impression that he really loves her, but she won't give him a male heir. So he's conflicted that way, because he's like, no, I need a male heir. And she, you know, and she's not getting pregnant. So anyway, that's my only issue with it, is the portrayal of Josephine is a little, I think they should have made her a stronger character, but I think it's, I mean, I loved it. A lot of people are hating it. People are joking that it's going to be Ridley Scott's Waterloo, you know, but,
I mean, it's almost impossible to go wrong with a Ridley Scott historical epic. Cause I mean, that guy kills it almost every time. And if he didn't kill it, it's probably because it wasn't the director's cut. Kingdom of Heaven director's cut is phenomenal.
I don't really like period pieces, so I kind of went into it. I mean, I like Joaquin Phoenix and I like Ridley Scott, but I really don't like period pieces. So I'm like, I kind of went into it, you know, and it's long. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes or 2 hours and 40 minutes. I saw it the same day as Hunger Games. So that was two hour and 40 minute movies that I had to sit through that day. But Napoleon was worth it. But yeah, the fact that I could be interested enough in a historical epic, you know, to like it it says a lot.
Did you see The Last Duel?
I like The Last Duel as well.
Last Duel was fucking phenomenal. I was pissed when I was like, why didn't this make all the money? Like, what the hell is going on here? Like, Last Duel fucking ruled. I was, which is why it also shocks me to hear that Josephine wasn't that well written, because the female characters in that one were written really well. So,
yeah, it has to be the writing, because Vanessa Kirby, I don't feel like I don't know what was wrong with it, but yeah, she's not as strong as, maybe I'm just reading into it too much into the actual historical accuracy. But yeah, that's my only issue. I feel like they should have made, because Josephine was not this meek, timid woman, you know, she was kind of a badass.
Speaking of historical pictures, I got to go to a early screening of the new A24 movie, The Iron Claw.
Yeah. Is that about the Von Erichs? Who is it? Oh. It's about a wrestling family, right?
Oh, it's about the Von Erichs, which, if you are a fan of Dark Side of the Ring or wrestling, you know the Von Erich story. And let's just say it's not a happy ending. The Iron Claw was phenomenal. Great performances all around. You know, Zac Efron really kills it. Jeremy Allen White, Harrison Dickinson, and Stanley Simmons all play the four main Von Erich brothers. And it's directed by Sean Durkin, who did, I'm going to look it up because I always get the names wrong. He did Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, which I always mess that up. I get like halfway through it, I'm like, Martha, May, Margaret, Mary. And Holt McElhenney played the father of Von Erich, which he's one of those actors that always pops up in like an action role as like one of the cooler henchmen or something, and then he did that FX series Lights Out a few years ago about the boxer. What I'm trying to say is he's one of those actors that has like an action hero face, but is actually like a really good dramatic actor. And he was phenomenal as the Father Von Erich. And it's really good because like it does follow the Von Erichs family from when, you know, they open up with the father in his prime wrestling and doing the Iron Claw move, and then him training the boys. And you see them go from like small time to being the powerhouses that they were, and how quickly and tragically that all falls apart. Try not to spoil too much, but yeah, if you know the history, you know what happens to all of them. But the focus isn't like in presenting like this is what happens. At the end of the day, the whole message of the movie is talking about these themes of like, a lot of the focus is how much the brothers love each other, which is really great. But it's also talking a lot about like toxic masculinity and the themes of like not letting your sons cry. But yeah, it really covers the themes of toxic masculinity, not showing emotions. Zac Efron's character, especially, you can see because he's the last surviving of the Von Erichs, and he, the entire movie, you can see that there's so much love for his brothers and for his family there, but he can't like express it. Like there's a lot of physicality that in that role that Efron does, and it works really well because there's moments where he's like trying to be like, hey, you okay, to his brothers who are like clearly not okay, and they're just like, yeah, it's fine. He's like, okay. And like, you know, he wants to say more, but he just like physically can't get it out, and it's really heart-wrenching. It was like an A24 screening, and so everyone who was there was like really chill and like really quiet, which was nice. Not a single phone was out the entire time, which was beautiful.
What theater was it at? Was it at an art house theater or was it an AMC?
Yeah, it was at the Samuel Golden Theater, which is like an office building with like a really nice theater in it that I think they just do for award screenings. But it was
because I think that has to do with it. I think that you get a more respectful audience. I think AMC is basically where.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. AMC is go. Yeah. Fucking trash. Again, I 32 minutes of trailers and commercials before I got to the fucking Nicole Kidman video, which, again, if you're someone, I can't believe people are still fucking cheering for that or like going like, yeah, oh, yeah, woo, and clapping for that fucking, like, why does a theater need to be advertising for itself when I'm already in there? Like, I'm already in here. You already have my money. Fuck off. Anyways, back to the Iron Claw. Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. So when it comes out in December, I highly recommend it. Just be ready to cry. There was one really great scene. Basically, there's a really slow reveal of what happened to one of the Von Erichs. That's very tragic. So when it happened, you just hear the loudest gasp from every audience member in the room. And I was sitting there going, oh, I know what happened. Oh, this is gonna, how are they gonna handle this? And as soon as it happened, just hearing from like half the room was incredible. But yeah, very powerful stuff. Very good. On the opposite side of, I wouldn't say opposite side of the dramatics because they really do get into the dramatics. Have you guys watched RoboDoc?
No, but I've seen a clip going around about the Oreo.
So, yeah, RoboDoc is a 4-part docuseries from friends of the podcast Chris Griffith Griffiths and Alan Eastwood, and it's all about RoboCop. They basically go scene by scene throughout the entire movie of RoboCop, and they go through the creative, the behind the scenes, almost every aspect. It's like, or was it Origin, the beginning of Alien or something? It's like that on steroids. It is beefy. It's 4.5 hours long total between the 4 episodes, and every minute of it is fucking amazing. It's, you can really see the passion and the love that Chris Griffiths and Alan Eastwood have for the movies with the interviews. They get really great candid stuff. They interview everybody. They got Peter Weller, Nancy Allen, they got Paul Verhoeven. And like, just it's incredible. And yes, there is a viral clip going around about Robo wants an Oreo. And I can tell you right now, that's not even the best story. That's just like the quickest, like one of the more ridiculous parts of it. But they went into every detail about like what it was like shooting in Dallas for Detroit at that time, which is really great. Because but it actually happened, made me laugh during Iron Claw, because Verhoeven said he wanted, when they were scouting, they wanted Dallas because Dallas just got built up in the 80s. And so there were still some parts that looked like garbage, but then some parts that looked very futuristic for its time, including the main building that had these green neon lights. But when they went to go shoot RoboCop, the green lights weren't working. And so they didn't get the thing that Paul wanted. But in Iron Claw, they show the Dallas skyline multiple times with the lights on. And I was like, oh, man, Iron Claw got what Verhoeven didn't. So, yeah, RoboDoc, it's on Screenbox streaming, and they just put out a Blu-ray for it, which Walmart has a really dope steelbook for. So highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. Really great stuff. It will kill your afternoon, though.
Okay. And speaking of fun, just in terms of first-time watches for sequels in an existing franchise, I think I've seen the greatest sequel in any franchise ever, Ghoulies 3, Ghoulies Go to College.
I thought you were going to say Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2.
Close enough.
Jay, I will fight you. Ghoulies 3, Ghoulies Go to College is way better than Book of Shadows.
This is true. Yeah, no, just basically me and my friends kept on joking about sequels and kept on joking about Ghoulies 3, Ghoulies Go to College, because that is probably one of the greatest sequel titles since Electric Boogaloo. And yeah, no, it's the third Ghoulies movie, and also it's the Ghoulies movie where they talk.
Hercules is such a weird franchise because, like, the first movie didn't know what it wanted, whether it wanted to be a comedy or like a straight up horror. And then I feel like Ghoulies 2 really nailed the tone of what it wanted to do. And then Ghoulies 3, they were just like, yeah, fuck it. Let's make a frat movie with these weird toilet demons.
Yeah, no, they just basically stuck the Ghoulies in a Animal House riff. And but the thing that really spurred me on is that legendary character actor Richard Kine plays the cat Ghoulie.
Really?
Yeah, he does the voice of the cat Ghoulie.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. No, the cast in this one's also very interesting too. Because, well, for one thing, Kane Hodder is in it, and he's in an opening gag where he gets thrown into a mop bucket and thrown down some stairs. And this was Matthew Lillard's very first movie, and he plays like a typical '80s college nerd with the suspenders and the glasses and the bowl cut, like Mandark. And Kevin McCarthy is the bad guy, and he plays the crusty old dean. And he basically looks like he just walked off the set of UHF straight into this with completely the same character. So it's very goofy, and it's directed by John Carl Beekler, the special effects, the practical effects artist who did the Ghoulies in the previous movies. And now he's in the director's chair, and he wanted to get really slapstick with it too, because like the three Ghoulies basically just act like the Three Stooges, with the frog toilet Ghoulie being Mo, the leader, and he smacks the other Ghoulies around, and they get into hijinks and shenanigans, and they kill people in very over the top ways. Like they flush a dude down the toilet, and they stick a plunger in somebody's face, psycho style. It's very wacky and goofy and very over the top. Like at one point, like they go full Looney Tunes, and somebody uses like a cartoon, like one of those round bombs with the fuse. It's amazing.
It's so great. It's so totally different. And it's also really funny because like the effects for the Ghoulies are really good. For the first two. And then for the third one, they went with like hand puppet things for the talking bits. And they're just like kind of ridiculous and remind me of like in the 90s when they had a lot of hand puppet toys at like fast food places. You know, remember like for dinosaur and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
But Ghoulies 3 is a treat. Like it's yeah. It's probably my favorite of the franchise. Although it just feels like the perfect
neck
like,
and neck
Ghoulies movie, right? So I haven't seen four yet.
Before we move on to our topic, let's talk real quick. Have you guys seen the Marvels?
I have.
No, not yet. I do want to because I want to support Nia DaCosta and everything she does. Because
I loved the Marvels. I actually love's a strong word. I liked it though, but I can understand why Marvel fans hate it. It's campy, you know, it's fun. Yeah. And that's not the kind of movie they want. Like at one point they go to a planet that they're trying to save where their language is song. So everybody on this planet sings, and it's like a Bollywood movie that they stepped into. But yeah, they have to. The only way anybody can understand them is if they sing. It's like it's their language is singing. So. And then and then there's also some real campy stuff that happens with the cats. It's like it's pretty crazy. But I mean, I really had fun. My favorite thing about it, an hour and 45 minutes. I'm so tired of these 2.5 hour superhero movies that, you know, I was so psyched when I saw that runtime. But anyway, the Marvels is not as bad as everyone's saying it is.
Yeah, I'd also like to chime in that, yeah, I thought it was fine. I really don't get all the hate it was getting. And also, Iman Vellani, who plays Miss Marvel, I thought she's really good. And she definitely has a lot of passion for the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the character. So, yeah, no, I hope she gets more leads, and, you know, I hope she gets to do more stories in that. Just the dynamic between Miss Marvel, Captain Marvel, and Photon, you know, just it was a really great dynamic.
Yeah, and she's great in the show Miss Marvel, which
once you
get past the first episode, is really really good.
Did Nia DaCosta do the show as well?
Nah. But the show is good. The first episode leans a bit too hard into if superheroes were real, they would have a real superhero Comic-Con thing. And then like nerding out, it kind of felt like, you know, a bit of a, you know, self-pleasuring of the MCU thing. But I'm trying to say that nicely. I don't know why I'm trying to be coy. I said turkey fucking scene five times earlier in this episode, but I
already checking the
explicit box.
Explicit box.
But after that, I know we have to because of me every time. But Miss Marvel, the show is really good, so I am excited to see the movie. And again, we'll always support Nia DaCosta. She fucking killed it with Candyman. So, and it's okay for comic book movies to be campy. Not everything has to be influenced by a Frank Miller comic. Okay, can we just like calm down on that? Like when people were like, "Oh, campy Daredevil, you can't make Daredevil campy." Daredevil was campy forever until Frank Miller's run. Like it's okay to be campy every now and then. I still say one of the best Batman movies ever is Lego Batman. Like that's just straight facts.
And Roger Corman's Fantastic Four has found its audience even as a bootleg.
Dude, like I was just talking with a friend the other day about how actually good like the Corman one is. They actually got Ben Grimm right, which no one yes. has done since. And Dr. Doom was fucking awesome.
Dr. Doom is what they got right as well. Yeah.
There's a lot wrong with that movie. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
But those two characters, it was like, holy shit, you actually get these characters. And then ever since then, everyone has been avoiding doing that for some godforsaken reason. It's like, it's not hard to do Doom right. He's just a dictator in a cool mask. Like, calm down. You don't need to. What do they always try to turn him into? Like some millionaire who has like a tragic life? Like, fuck off. No, Doom is, come on. And then Grimm, be tragic as shit with it. Like, come on. Anyways. Enough about comic books.
Yeah, let's move on to our topic, which we're a little late to the party here because everyone's probably already watched it, but Fall of the House of Usher and more broadly Edgar Allan Poe is what we want to talk about.
Yes.
We've all been through Fall of the House of Usher, right?
Oh yeah.
I think I beat you all to it. That was like week one for me.
I finished it up last night, so yeah. You totally beat me.
I made second place.
Yeah. I mean, we're huge Flanagan's fans in this house. So
we're Flanagan's, if you will.
Flana fans.
Yeah, I was going to say Flana fans.
We're just Flans.
What I really dug about the miniseries is it's not really it kind of just uses the skeleton of the Fall of the House of Usher story, and it plays its way through the Usher family, which it kind of adds all those characters so that it can play its way through the rest of Poe's catalog, because every episode seems to it focuses on one of the Usher children and their demise as it relates to another Edgar Allan Poe story. So you know, you've got the murders in the Rue Morgue one where she gets ripped apart by a baboon or an orangutan.
Oh, unless we forget Mask of the Red Death. That was one of my favorite versions.
That was the best episode.
Second episode. Yeah. No, just yeah. Really hit it off.
Hardcore. And they did.
Pit in the Pendulum.
It wasn't with. Yeah. The Pit in the Pendulum. That was pretty creative.
That was so gnarly.
They did a Cask of Amontillado. In the last episode, but it wasn't on one of the Usher kids. It kind of explained, it's more of like an origin, but oh yeah. And the black cat with the guy and the
Raul.
It was a hell of a black cat.
Yeah.
I mean, and the thing is they keep going back, even they keep reciting parts of Poe's poetry, and not just the Raven either, which is awesome. You know, they do Sea by the Sea and all this other, you know, you can tell that Flanagan knows his Poe.
I loved it so much. Like the thing with Poe, though, you have to remember, and this is, and we'll discuss this more with the other adaptations,
that he's better than Lovecraft. Yeah, I agree.
And a lot less racist. That's for sure.
Oh, yes.
It's kind of funny. Well, it's not funny, but it's interesting how it seems like TikTok recently discovered the name of Lovecraft's cat, and there's a lot of memes going around about it, and we can't say it on this podcast, but yeah, that's interesting. Anyways, but like Poe's stories are short. They're all short stories. So anytime there's an adaptation of Poe, you have to extend it. So it makes sense. Like, oh, we're going to do a Poe miniseries, having each episode be like having the skeleton of Fall of House of Usher, and then each episode kind of being more influenced and more about a different story makes so much sense. It's almost, it's kind of crazy, like, well, how no one has done that before. And Flanagan pulled it off perfectly. Before, I mean, there's times where it's like a lot of Corman adaptations of Poe, it was more the third act is the short story, and then they create all the first two acts on it. So that, but so if you're like, oh, I'm tired of this, you just wait till the third act and then you'll get your full Poe. But
yeah,
Corman always did a good job with that anyways. But yeah, no, it was absolutely phenomenal, and it's up there. I mean Midnight Mass is still my favorite, but Fallout House of Usher, I feel, is a close second for me, at least in my favorites of Flanagan series, I'll say. But yeah, man, that Pay in the Pendulum death was
I did not expect it to go that way.
If there's someone out there who didn't realize that they were bisexual before that, Raul and Kate Sagal will definitely get you to question things, because both of them were at like peak hotness in that show. Like, goddamn.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of bisexuality throughout this series.
Oh, man. It's like, I feel like this might be this generation's 1999's The Mummy, of just like awakening bisexuality in people.
And yeah, no, and I really liked it too, because Wall, you know, is definitely following the Edgar Allan Poe stories, and it was very much in line for Mike Flanagan's style of storytelling, you know, with Roderick Usher relegating the story to the DA. It also kind of had a Tales from the Crypt kind of vibe to it, mostly in that, you know, rich assholes getting their comeuppance, because you know, there was a very delicious irony to every character's death, and you know, just kind of the layers and building up to the demises.
Yeah, so they're poetic.
Extremely so.
The deaths, like let's talk Mask the Red Death, the guy who throws the party.
Yeah, Prince Prospero.
Yeah, Prospero. You know, he's killed by his own party, by his own corner cutting at his party that he was trying to, you know, he throws this big, almost like a rave party, and it's in an abandoned building, and he clearly is not permitted, and that's what ends up killing not only him but most of his guests.
Oh, and Carla Gugino was just so phenomenal in it. Just, I mean, Carla's been in like three of his projects. Yeah, right.
Well, I think he's found like a stable that he likes to work with, because also the I don't know her name, but the woman who plays Annabelle Lee in House of Usher, she's from Absentia way back, you know, his first movie. And she's got little bit parts, you know, and, up through. So,
and Dr. Sleep, too, right? Wasn't she?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, I believe so. I think that, you know, she's just one that he likes to work with, where even if he doesn't have a starring role for her, he'll find something. And I think she was perfect as Annabelle Lee.
I mean, this was like pulling, this had actors from every one of his projects. There was a bunch of Midnight Club kids in there. There was, you know, his usual staples of Henry Thomas, Raoul, all of them. And I'm really stoked that Mark Hamill seems to be getting into that rotation, because he's also in the upcoming Stephen King adaptation that Flanagan's doing as well. And Mark Hamill, like, it's one of those things, again, everyone online is like, whoa, Mark Hamill can act. It's like, well, we all knew that. If you saw The Guyver, you would know, or Prince of Darkness, you would know boy's got range. But like,
listen to his Joker. I mean, when you hear, yeah, you hear him voicing the Joker. Yeah, you know, the guy's got chops.
Oh yeah. But in this, phenomenal.
The funny thing, though, is that with his role as Mr. Pym, you know, the hatchet man for the Usher family, his deep, gravelly voice actually was reminiscent of his voice he did for Regular Show as Skips the Yeti.
Yeah. Like,
have either of you seen Regular Show?
I've seen a couple episodes.
But yeah, no, because like in Regular Show, he plays a Yeti handyman named Skips, who has that same deep, gravelly voice. So, I mean, It was different enough, but at the same time, it was reminiscent enough that it also made me think of that character. So you know, it was just a thing.
Yeah, but he was phenomenal, dude. Like,
oh no, he was amazing. Like, he was genuinely at his most threatening, just because like he's this Renaissance man. He's a lawyer. He was an explorer. He's definitely a hitman for the Usher family.
So good.
And actually, yeah, no, watching The Fall of the House Usher and then finishing, it actually inspired me to rewatch the Corman Poe cycle of movies, which for those of you who don't know, in the 1960s, Roger Corman struck cinematic gold by doing several adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe's works as feature movies, pretty much all of which starred one of the greatest icons of horror for his time, Vincent Price.
Of all time.
Did any of them not star Vincent Price?
No, I think he was on all of them.
Yeah, I think he was as well. They were considered Vincent Price and Roger Corman's Poe cycle. Yeah.
Yes, of course. And the funny thing is that the first movie they did in 1960 was The Fall of the House of Usher with Vincent Price as Roderick Usher. Yeah, that was right off the bat. And, actually, this was my first time seeing the Corman, Poe, Price, Fall of the House of Usher. I'd never gotten around to it for some reason. But it was interesting because I got the Scream Factory Blu-ray from the Vincent Price set, which has the PBS intros and outros by Price. And he was talking about how that kind of came together and like how Corman, you know, when he pitched it, like gothic horror wasn't really his in. So like the other producer's like, we need a monster. So Corman was like, the house is the monster. And they were like, OK, roll with it. And Vincent Price for the role, like he actually bleached his hair blonde and shaved off his mustache because Roderick Usher hasn't seen the light of day in years. So he wanted to look like an albino. And it's like one of the few movies I've never seen him with. I've seen him without the mustache.
And they're so good. And it's interesting because that was during those movies are what made Corman the director that he is. I mean, as a name and stuff, because he essentially was it New World? They were mainly doing like double feature drive-ins. And so they would take the budget of one movie to make two movies. And he was like, all right, well, I have a crazy idea. What if we took the budget of one movie and just made one movie? And like made it really good. And they were like, I don't know if that's going to work. And he's like, well, listen, Poe is public domain, so we can do adaptations and not have to pay Poe because Poe's dead in his public domain. And we already have a name attached to it. And they're like, OK, so if you attach like a horror name to it, you know, and Vincent probably was starting to come up in that world with that. And so it became this like perfect blend. And he wanted to do Mask of the Red Death first, but they didn't quite have like the budgets and stuff, so they did a few. And Mask of the Red Death, I think, is the crown jewel of those adaptations. They're all great, but that one was phenomenal. And they shot the whole thing in England because at the time it was cheaper to shoot in England, but because of that, it added an authenticity of the sets. They were able to use a lot of the sets that were being used for other gothic horror movies at the time, castle locations, and they just had like a stellar English cast in that one as well. With you got Vincent Price, you got Patrick McGee, who is phenomenal in it, and it's just all around Jane Usher, Hazel Court. I mean, it's beautifully shot, the colors pop, and it's just such a great adaptation, especially at the end when you see the different deaths in their different colored robes meet and talk. Yeah.
And I got to say, Vincent Price's Prince Prospero is one of my favorite villain roles for him because he is such an asshole. Like, he is just deliciously evil and proud of it. Like, he even says he's excited to go to hell. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's like right up there with his role as Judge Hopkins from The Witchfinder General, which was also one of Price's kind of signature villains. Because in the other Poe Corman movies, you know, he's either kind of more of a enigmatic figure, or he's crazy in one or two of them, or not necessarily heroic, but kind of nominal in a couple of them. But yeah, no, like in Mask of the Red Death, he's straight up evil with a capital E, and he relishes in it.
Yeah.
Have you guys ever seen Extraordinary Tales?
You mean Tales of Terror?
No, it's called Extraordinary Tales. It's from maybe 10 years ago. It's five animated Poe stories.
Oh.
And they're like narrated by, I think, Bela Lugosi does one, Christopher Lee. Julian Sands, I think, is in there as well. But it's just they're like animated. They're like animated versions of his short stories.
Yeah. And did Guillermo del Toro?
Yeah. GDT narrates one as well. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I got to look that up.
Like The Pit and the Pendulum is one, and The Telltale Heart obviously is one. Mask of Red Death is in there as well. The Fall of the House of Usher is one, and I don't remember the fifth one. I don't think it's Murders in the Rue Morgue, but it's there's a fifth one in there as well.
Oh, also, while we're talking animated Poe adaptations, one of my personal favorites and one that kind of helped me introduce me to Poe would be The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, episode one, where they did a straight up reading of The Raven with James Earl Jones as the narrator.
Yeah. And Bart as the Raven goes, yeah. Eat my shorts.
Yeah, no, that cracked me up, especially like, you know, just having Dan Castellaneta as Homer reading the actual Edgar Allan Poe lines and saying stuff like, oh, quaff is thee.
Whenever I can't read the word nevermore without hearing it in Bart's voice. Nevermore.
Nevermore. Nevermore. Nevermore. Nevermore.
So good. Even when watching Fall of the House of Usher, like when he says nevermore, I just that iconic image of Bart as the Raven popped in. I knew one of us was going to bring that up because that is probably one of the best adaptations of Poe out there. And it is interesting because he's public domain. So you get to see a lot of people kind of do it for cheap because there was Corman in like the 60s. And then it kind of happened again in the 80s where you saw a lot of Full Moon adaptations of Poe as well, where you get like.
Oh, yeah. Stuart Gordon did Pin the Pendulum.
Yeah. Which is really interesting because they kind of lean more into not body horror, but a lot of like torture horror with it more so. And it's fine. It's not Gordon's strongest, but it's still a lot of fun, you know, especially.
I mean, you got Lance Henriksen as the chief torturer.
Yeah, is Lance Henriksen completely shaved head, just like going ham on people. It's yeah, you can definitely tell that it was Gordon trying to do more of like a Witchfinder general type deal with that character, you know.
They also in the early 90s, they did that Two Evil Eyes with Argento and Romero.
Oh, like yeah,
a double shot with the Black Cat and I think M. Valdemar is the other one.
Yeah, it was.
Was there two or three stories with that one?
No, it was two, because Two Evil Eyes.
Yeah.
That's right, because
only Two Evil Eyes.
It was going to be a series, right? And then they ended up not being able to do a full series, so they just did two of the stories for the movie.
Yeah, although the thing was is that in Argento's segment, The Black Cat, there are a lot of references and homages to other Poe stories, because like, who starred in that one again?
Is it Harvey Keitel?
Harvey Keitel, yeah, because like Harvey Keitel is a crime photographer, and a lot of the crimes he's taking pictures of are Edgar Allan Poe stories, because like there's a dude who gets ripped in half by the Pit and the Pendulum.
And crime scene photographer's name is Rod Usher.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
So there's layers. Also, back on the Simpsons Raven episode, I was also going to add that it ends on one of my favorite lines from The Simpsons, where Bart complains that the Raven wasn't scary, and Lisa chimes in that I guess people were a lot easier to scare back in the 19th century. And Bart's like, oh, yeah, it's like when you look back on the original Friday the 13th, it's pretty tame by today's standards.
Which is great. Did you guys ever see The Pale Blue Eye?
Oh, I didn't see it, but that one, that really... It's the Netflix one with Christian Bale. That doesn't really have anything to do with Poe, except he's a character in it, doesn't it?
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. It's like they're investigating an actual murder, and it's when Poe was in the military.
Yeah, it's a weird one. It's from Scott Cooper, who did Antlers, Black Mass, Crazy Heart, and like Hostiles. So he's worked with Bale a lot. And yeah, Edgar Allan Poe is a character in it. I don't know if it's an adaptation. I don't think it's an adaptation of any Poe's work, but it's an adaptation of a book where Poe is a character. It's a strange one, because it felt like it should have been better than it was. It's still solid, but like, yeah, the Poe is played by Harry Melling from Queen's Gambit, and he is really good in it. But I think they do some like prosthetics on his face that are a bit distracting. It's a solid like little dad thriller, you know what I mean? Like it feels very like trying to do like edgy Poe dad crime thriller, but like we throw Poe in it. I don't know. It's interesting. It's worth a watch.
That's what Scott Cooper does, is dad movies.
He does do dad. He's the Ron Howard of like horror thrillers, isn't he? Like,
yeah. Closing this out, we'll go to another where Poe's a character. Did you guys see The Raven?
With John Cusack.
Yeah, no. With John Cusack. Yeah, John Cusack plays Poe. And basically, it's kind of like Follow the House of Usher. There's a series of murders around Baltimore that are inspired by Poe's stories. So Poe actually helps try to solve this murderer that's basically taken his MO. So it's more, it's not really adapted from any of his stories, but inspired by it.
Yeah. What did Poe moonlight as like a murder investigator? Cause like, We just listed off two movies where he did that.
I don't think he did, but
makes for a good story.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah,
he'd make a good investigator because a lot of his stories. I mean, if you're familiar with the stories, like even Murders in the Rue Morgue, it's like they're like mysteries. They're murder mysteries instead of just like horror tales. So,
but he writes them so like weirdly that you can see how like someone would be like, oh yeah, it's horror. It's like, a crime thriller. So maybe Poe is really gothic dad literature, you know?
Gothic dad literature. Yeah, sure. Hey, like I said, he's better than Lovecraft. People always fight me on that, but Poe's better than Lovecraft.
Yeah.
He's no Maupassant, but he's definitely better than Lovecraft.
And nothing wrong with making stuff for the dads. I love dad movies. Ron Howard. If Ron Howard makes another racing movie, I'm there.
I'm waiting for my Solo sequel.
It could happen.
Yeah. I want a series, but anyways.
All right, let's wrap this one up. What are your favorite Poe adaptations? What'd you think of The Fall of the House of Usher? Of course, the ending is spoiled by the title because the literal house falls in all of these. But yeah, let's hear it. Let us know.
Oh, I just got that. Fuck.
Hmm.
Wow. I think this is like the third time in like a month we've gotten me going, oh, the obvious thing. Gotcha.
That's awesome. Oh, that's awesome. All right. So did it take you as long as it took Korea to get the double meaning of The Fall of the House of Usher? Let us know.
It's only a month.
Our theme song is by Restless Spirits, so go check them out. And our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so go check him out. You can find us at Ion Horror on any of the socials or at ihorror.com. You can catch Jacob on the Halloween. That's hard to say.
It's a bit of a tongue twister.
The Hallow Rewind. So if you miss us in the off weeks, go check him out there. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Korea.
Keep your eye on horror.